Let's find out what's been making headlines this week with Tony Allen. Now, quite a shock to most that Indonesia wants to buy a huge tract of land in northern Australia.
Yes, Libby, we've talked quite a bit about how Indonesia is trying to become self-sufficient in beef and to boost its own beef supply. There have been a lot of questions about how Indonesia can achieve this. Well, this week it is reported that the Indonesian cabinet has approved a plan to buy 1 million hectares of Australian farmland, raise cattle there, and then ship them back to Indonesia for Indonesians to eat. To give you a sense of perspective on that, that would be an area about four times the size of the ACT. The beef prices in Indonesia have hit record highs over the past year. The self-sufficiency policy that Indonesia has introduced has also restricted imports from Australia and elsewhere. So it's all quite a radical plan, really, and the local media in Indonesia are saying the cattle would be bred in Australia and brought across to Indonesian feedlots, and once the appropriate land is found here, it would still need approval for Indonesia to buy it from the Foreign Investment Review Board. So what's it all going to cost and where might it be? There is an estimate around that was mentioned previously that Indonesia had about $30 million to spend. We spoke to a station agent in the north, Russell Wolf, who said that might mean you'd have to buy two or three properties to get 1 million hectares, and it might be hard to find something if your budget was only $30 million.
Anyone's going to invest in 1 million hectares, they'll probably be looking at the better quality country. And if they're looking at part of the Northern Territory or Northern Australia, it'll be in excess of $80 million.
That's extraordinary when you think about the implications of that as far as welfare and live animal exports. We're going to be looking at it a little bit later on in the program, but if Indonesia owns the cattle, what happens?
Well, there's a whole lot of questions here, and foreign investment did come up as quite a big issue for agriculture
in
the election campaign. The government's in a bit of hiatus, obviously, in this first week, so we haven't really heard from the Australian government.
They're probably rather relieved they are, so they've got time to
think about
it. But
there has been a generally approving view from the Northern Territory cattle industry, who seem to think it's not a bad idea.
Now, speaking of the election, the National Farmers Federation is asking the new government to do something about cutting red and green tape.
Yes, you might recall that the coalition did promise if elected, it would cut up to $1 billion in red tape bureaucracy for business. Well, the National Farmers Federation, we haven't even got an agriculture minister yet, but the National Farmers Federation is saying, here's our list. Get started. A recent World Economic Forum report did rank Australia 128th out of 147 countries for its burden of government regulation. And the latest figures we have on farming are from 2007, which show that bureaucracy costs the average farm $22,000 a year, or 14% of the average profit. So it is substantial. NFF Chief Executive Matt Liniger says this list of regulations the Federation wants to cut as soon as possible will be discussed in detail with the new government.
Particularly in the areas of environmental regulation, transport. We know labour is another one. We talked about ag vet chemicals and data collection. There will be more, but they're the ones we've focused on. Not all regulations are bad. You know, they are required, but oftentimes, you know, we don't have that sort of flexible or common sense approach to their implementation.
Milk production is actually now predicted to rise.
Yes, not by much, but it's a good sign. This year they're expecting 9.5 billion litres of milk to be produced in Australia, much of it for export. That's up about 2%. And a Dairy Australia report out this week shows, despite all the complaints we've heard from dairy farmers, 73% of them are feeling confident about the future. That's a big rise, up from 44% in a survey in February. The most optimistic farmers are in Tasmania. More than 90% of Tasmanian farmers think they're going to do pretty well, and Queenslanders are the most pessimistic. We'll hear from one of them in a moment. But Dairy Australia's Norman Repicholi says, it's all very well, all this talk of optimism and more milk and all that, but it's hard to say what it means for the prices that the farmers will actually get for their milk.
And one of the things that's also changed internally too, because of the nature of milk pricing now, we're not going out there to market with a milk price similar to what we've done previously. The indications that the manufacturers are giving is certainly looking like they're going to close over $6. From that perspective, I'd be inclined to go with what the manufacturers are talking about.
Now, as I mentioned, in Queensland, they're not that confident. It was 35% confidence in Queensland, and Queensland and Western Australia are the two states where they rely almost entirely on supermarket sales rather than exports. David Scholl from Biggenden, 400 kilometres north of Brisbane, is one farmer who's getting out. He says it's the plummeting milk prices that have put him out of business. He sold his 120 milking cows and blames the supermarket price war.
We should be being paid a dollar a litre, not the public buying it for a dollar a litre. Our cost of production is 64.9 cents a litre, and we're being paid 54 cents a litre. So we're losing 10 cents a litre.
Even I can work that out. Now, more milk, also more grain.
Yes, things are looking pretty good for grain, even though there's been some dry patches as well as some wet ones. South Australia is on track for its third largest grain crop in history. The Primary Industries Crop and Pasture Report says this year's crop could reach about 8.7 million tonnes, and that would have an export value for South Australia close to $3 billion. The state's largest grain crop was 3 years ago, and they had more than 10 million tonnes then, so this is the third best. Grains Industry Account Manager Dave Lewis says it's a pretty exciting time for the growers. They've had a good year.
Well, it certainly is. It's a reflection of what grain growers have been able to achieve over the years and adoption of new technologies and some very good winter rainfall that's occurred this year on top of a very timely seeding.
Now, in many parts of Australia, we've had an inordinately warm winter coming into spring, and it might not be good for wine.
Well, the wine-grown grape growers on the southern tablelands of New South Wales are having their earliest bud burst in 40 years. That's when the little buds come out on the grapevines. They look a bit woolly and a green shoot comes out, and that's because of the record warm winter. It's 3 weeks earlier than normal, the bud burst. Shouldn't be a problem unless, as Ken Helm from Murrin Bateman points out, the fruit on the younger grapes gets wiped out by frost.
We know that towards the end of October that we do have low temperatures and we have a very high incidence of frosts in the last week of October. And a frost and these tender little buds that you see here and these little green shoots, they don't like frost. And if we lose those, we don't get any fruit.
Have you seen what they sometimes do in those sort of circumstances? They can bring out helicopters and they just hover above the vineyards trying to keep the air circulating.
It's an
extremely
bit
expensive way of doing it.
A bit like Kerry Packer bringing the Channel 9 helicopter to dry up the wet patches on the cricket ground, isn't it? Same principle.
Yes.
And well, while we're talking about the warm spring weather, it's been a hive of activity, you might say, in Young, the cherry capital of New South Wales. The weather has brought out the bees to pollinate the fruit trees. A very mild winter and triggered the blossom to flower slightly earlier this season. Stone fruit grower Andrew Ricketts says it's a bit unusual to string together such good weather.
We've had an exceptional run of pollination weather. Most years you'll get a day or two where it's semi-wintery and the bees have to have a day off. They don't work under about 12 degrees and the ideal 16 degrees upwards. So we've had a lot of days above that where the bee activity has been very strong.
I don't work under 12
degrees. I was
just
thinking we should bring in some sort of temperature regulation.
He is pleased with that pollination, as I mentioned, but there is a bit of a worry in this case. There's always a downside, isn't there, that there wasn't enough winter chill for the cherry trees to produce a good crop of fruit. We'll have to see, but overall the cherry crop's showing potential this year.
And camels aren't just the boats of the desert now, they're the cheesemakers of the desert.
Blessed are the cheesemakers indeed. The world's first camel cheese products have hit supermarket shelves in the Middle East. A commercial dairy was established in Dubai in 2006. They've now got more than 3,400 camels there, and they milk them every day, and they're making cheese out of camels for the first time. Kirsten Langer from Emirates Industry for Camel Milk and Products says they not only have camel cheese, they also have camel milk chocolate, and it's all growing in popularity.
The challenge with camels is they give a lot less milk than cows, 7 litres per day as opposed to 25 and more. We have three different types of cheese that makes us all very proud, because usually people tend to say that Dubai absorbs everything from outside. So So this is basically our chance to bring something to the world.
Hands up, who wants to milk a camel?
Yes.
Bags not.
Apparently the cheese is pretty expensive and it's a luxury deli item.
Oh, I can imagine. Tony, thank you. Tony Allen with this week's Rural News.